You're listening to the Story of Woman podcast with Lindsay Hansen Park. We've talked a lot on this podcast about Africa. In case you're maybe a little foggy on the geography, we talk a lot about South Africa because that is where a lot of the what we call the cradle of civilization lies. And it's in this sort of cradle of civilization that we're still trying to understand the origins of how we came to be us, human, women. It is near the largest city in South Africa, Johannesburg, that there is a series of caves, a cave system that has been known for a long time, since the early 1930s, to help us unlock these secrets of early human origins. It's the Stekfontein Caves, Africanus for strong spring, and it's a bunch of limestone caves that have been catching the interest of scientists for years. Stekfontein Caves is the world's richest hominid fossil site. It's got thousands of discoveries that have been excavated there since 1935. And it's also one of the sites of one of the world's largest continuous paleoanthropological digs in the world. You can go there, people can travel to these caves, and you can visit the World Heritage Site, which takes visitors on an exploration deep into these incredible caves. It's just an hour away from Johannesburg, and it's a great way to go and see understanding human origins in the works. Before you go and enter the caves, you can be guided through a fantastic scientific exhibition center where they have all of these incredible fossils on display for you to see. Discoveries made in the caves date back to the birth of humanity more than 4 million years ago. And if you go there, you can learn about how hominids survived on Earth and see 2 million-year-old stone tools. And then when you're done with the museum, you can stroll along the wooden walkway with views of the cradle of humankind and the excavation site where scientists are still working. Among the remarkable findings that this cave has given the world are the famous Mrs. Ples, the first complete Australopithecus skull to be discovered, and Littlefoot, which is a 4.17 million year old, almost complete ape-man skeleton discovered in the same caves. But the caves still keep giving us treasures. And it was on September 13th of 2013 that a group of explorers named Rick Hunter and Steve Tucker decided to go caving in the Stekfontein cave system. They found a narrow vertically oriented chimney or chute that was really, really narrow. And they crawled down it, crawled up it, crawled through it. And it's there that they discovered a room about 30 meters, 98 feet underground, which we now call the Dinaletti Chamber. And it was littered with fossil bones. And when these cavers found it, they decided to show their findings to paleoanthropologist Lee Berger, who had a great interest in these caves for some time. National Geographic, along with the South African National Research Foundation, decided to fund an expedition. And the excavation hired 6 female paleoanthropologists who could pass through an opening only 7 inches wide to the Dinaletti Chamber. It was a really tight squeeze, so they had to find scientists who could fit this category. These 6 female paleoanthropologists and scientists became known as the underground astronauts, which is super cool. Now, we've already interviewed one of them, Hannah Morris, on the last episode. And if you haven't listened to that episode, I highly recommend you going back and listening to that. This expedition was named the Rising Star Expedition after sort of the area. And it came to the public's attention when they discovered all of these hominin fossils in a separate chamber that they call the Dinaletti Chamber or the Chamber of Stars. It's said that more than 1,200 fossil elements were recovered and cataloged in just November of 2013. And that would have represented a dozen individuals. And then a lot of the bones came in 2014 as well. Over, I think it was over 1,700 specimens were recovered in April of 2014. Some of the fossils that they found included skulls, jaws, ribs, teeth, bones, and almost a complete hand and foot, and bones of an inner ear. And what's remarkable about this is they were bones of old, young, and infants were found. And it's so unusual to have a find like this where there are fossils this old with such an amazing range of diversity in biological sex and age. What they found eventually would be 15 partial skeletons in this tiny underground chamber. And what is strange about it is the location. Scientists are beginning to believe that the fossils were deliberately deposited, which means that these creatures, the Naledi, deliberately carried the dead and put them here. Now, some are calling it a burial, but the scientists are careful not to use the word burial. It's still an issue of controversy. So I'm really lucky to talk to three more of the underground astronauts today, Ellen Furigal, Becca Pisciotto, and Marina Elliott, who were on the dig. And I'm going to let you listen to the interviews that I did with them. We're going to start first with Ellen Furigal. She was a member of the Rising Star Expedition, and she is going to talk to us about her passion for paleoanthropology.
Hello, my name is Ellen Furigal. I'm a paleoanthropologist, and I was a member of the Rising Star Expedition and a part of the team that subsequently described the material that we excavated.
That's fantastic. So tell us a little bit about your background and what you got you interested in anthropology.
I started off in a Bachelor of Arts of Cultural Anthropology. And what happened was I took a course in evolutionary anthropology on a whim and kind of just fell in love. I always really liked osteology. And it was sort of the ideal blending of my interests in biology and evolution with my interest in anthropology.
So how did you get involved with the project?
I got involved with the project the same way everyone else on the team did. I saw an advertisement that was initially put out on Facebook by Lee Berger, who's the coordinator of the expedition, the lead, the head of it. And I submitted my resume with an outline of my caving experience as well as my excavation experience and my academic qualifications. Just on the off chance that I might get a look in, you never know. But I wasn't really too hopeful at the time. And to my shock and incredible pleasure, Lee called me back.
So you go down to South Africa. What happens when you get there?
On the first day, I was met by some of the team members at the airport, and they took me off to the hotel, and then it was a house that we were staying in at the time. And I met Lee for the first time there on the night that I arrived. And he sort of started giving us once all the six of us had arrived, he started giving us a rundown of what the site was, where it was, some of the difficulties associated with getting into the site, the reason why we were chosen, and a preview of some of the material that we were supposed to be excavating. And from there it was probably one of the most intense and fast-paced excavations I've ever been on. It was very much from the moment we landed, we were into it. We were training, we were sort of exploring the system, and then we were excavating.
So tell me about your first time in the cave.
The first time in the cave was a sort of a team-building exercise. So we went in just to explore the system a bit and get our feel for it, because each cave system has its own sort of personality, its own nature, so it's good to familiarize yourself with the quirks of the system, or as many as you can, before you actually start doing work within it. So that was the first trip in, and it was just obviously there was the air of excitement. I mean, that was palpable, but it was also the air of exploration, of discovery. I think it was the most exciting bit for me, because we were sort of moving into parts of the system that haven't really been explored before, and it was just a monumental privilege.
So I'm really interested in this part. Fossils have been found all over this part of Africa, and it's something people have known about a while. But this cave was super hard to find access to. Tell us about how the Naledi people, well, people's wrong word. Tell us about how the Naledi would have gotten into the cave. Do you have any sense of that?
At the moment, our best hypothesis, our best scenario that we figured out is that they were traveling through the system much the same way we were. So there isn't much evidence to suggest that there have been entrances to the archaeological site area any closer to where they currently exist today. So it seems as though Homo Naledi was moving through the system through much the same path that we use, through the Superman crawl up the dragon's back, and then eventually to the chute, or the top of the chute. And I think that there's no evidence to suggest really that they were deliberately moving down the chute themselves with what I'm assuming to be corpses at the time. But what they may have been doing is dropping the bodies of their relatives from the top of the chute and then letting gravity pull them down through the chute to the archaeological site.
Okay, that makes sense. So I know it's super early and there's going to be a lot of analysis done and, you know, more pieces to this puzzle. But tell us what we can know about Homo Naledi so far.
Well, I think a lot of people are very stuck on the idea of having a date, because the date preloads us with expectations about what it should and shouldn't be. But ideally, any kind of information that we gleaned about Homo Naledi should be done in exclusion of the date, because it means that we are free from those kinds of biases. So what we do know is that they were a surprising mosaic in terms of their anatomy of human-like and ape-like features, or australopith-like features. They've got these incredibly, you know, derived feet and legs that are clearly indicative of something that was bipedal. But then we're coupling it with a more australopith-like, or even a unique pelvis, thorax, shoulder, and well, to a certain extent, some features of the hands are also much more ape-like than human, but they do seem to have a fairly human-like hand morphology in terms of digit lengths and things like that. So, I mean, and in terms of the cranium as well, incredibly derived relative to most australopiths, except for the small brains. So they have these small brains that are sort of, I think they're 550 cc's in terms of size, but it's coupled with this, you know, dentition that's relatively small compared to their brain size. Usually, like in the fossil record, what we usually see is that small brain things tend to be coupled with fairly large teeth. And so the fact that Homo Naledi and to a certain extent Australopithecus sediba and whatever their relatives may be have these small brains with small dentition sort of really makes us question about the trajectory of brain versus diet change.
It's incredible to me to think that you guys were down there, you know, in this cave that was inhabited, you know, by ancient Homo Naledi, like these creatures that have been there possibly millions of years ago. So tell us about the actual find. How many fossils did you find, and what were their biological sex?
So we have 1,550 individual specimens that we've excavated so far, which amounts to, we think, around 15 individuals when we did the analyses of the remains. In terms of their sexes, it looks as though we've got a mix of male and female. We've also got a fairly broad sort of diversity of age ranges as well, from neonates through to quite old individuals, which is utterly bizarre in the fossil record. You just don't see that kind of demographic profile, at least in most African sites.
This is shaking up the scientific world, and I think we'll continue to tell us more about it. But overall, in the bigger picture, what does this tell you personally about how we understand our human origins?
I think we really need to reevaluate ultimately what it means to be a part of the genus Homo. Because we in the past we've had these what amount to assumptions about what it means to be included in Homo that are you know, with finds like Homo naledi and Australopithecus sediba are slowly being completely rewritten. So it's, I think we need to do some re-examining of those kinds of assumptions, and particularly about the cognitive capacities and its relationships to brain size, because clearly these are small brain creatures that have quite complex thinking patterns, or at least, you know, clear indications of relationships to their dead. You know, they are quite capable of thinking about their relatedness and their relationship to these bodies.
That's fantastic. Well, I want to know a little bit more about you. So tell us what you're currently working on and what gets you really excited when you in the field of work that you're in.
So at the moment, I'm at the tail end of my PhD, and I am particularly interested in human evolutionary biomechanics. So how form relates to function in terms of our skeletal anatomy, and how function can inform the evolutionary trajectory, particularly of the shoulder girdle. So I'm really interested in how the shoulder was molded over time by the behaviors that we were participating in, particularly tool use. And I mean, in my field, this is going to sound utterly, utterly nerdy, but I just really like humeri, upper arm bones. I just, yeah, they're, I find them really appealing for some reason. So whenever I see that a new site has come out with something, some humeral remains that are really nice and complete, I get pretty damn excited.
Well, are you comfortable talking more about that? I would love for you to tell us more about that if you're
okay. Yeah, sure. So, my project particularly, I'm looking, I'm using electromyography, which is a technique that looks at muscle recruitment patterns using electrodes in modern humans to look at the biomechanical forces that are exerted across the shoulder girdle during older ones stone napping. So there's a bit of an argument in the literature as to the role of tool use and manufacture versus other behaviors like throwing, and what kind of role that they've played in the evolution of the modern human shoulder girdle. Because we're quite unique compared to our ancestors, and particularly to great apes in a lot of respects. And it's not quite clear how some of these features have arisen. So what I'm hoping to do is to clarify what exactly is happening at the shoulder girdle and what forces are being exerted there in order to, like, so that, like, yeah, what forces are being exerted there and how it's shaping the morphology of the shoulder.
So are you saying, like, great apes can't throw, like, humans? They couldn't throw a softball?
Not really, no. Like, humans have very particular ways of throwing, very particular biomechanical patterns. Great apes can throw, and they can throw quite effectively in some cases, but they often do it differently from us.
And so how would our ability to throw in the way that we throw help us maybe develop in the way that we did?
Well, I mean, it could be advantageous for things like spear throwing, or even deterring predators by throwing rocks. So, I mean, there are selective advantages in being able to throw well.
Fascinating. Yeah, I didn't think of the spear throwing, of course. So when you were excavating these fossils, were you paying particular attention to which bones were being found and geeking out on those on the site?
Yeah, like particularly when there was one day I spotted the head of a humerus of it's the fossil UW101283, which is our nice complete humerus. And I noticed it. It had clearly over time rolled through the system and then down one of the little gutters alongside it. And I spotted it down there one day, and we eventually sent Marina in. She had to brace herself on either side of the wall because there was fossil material all over the floor of it, and we couldn't walk down the back of it without potentially crushing some of this stuff. So it was quite an ordeal to get it out. And I was super pleased to see it because it was the first, you know, real diagnostic-looking humeral material that we've managed to find. And
Oh, I love it. It's so exciting to hear you be passionate about something like this. And like I told Hannah in the first interview, it's just so inspiring for me to talk to women who are doing amazing things in the field, who are sort of living the dream. And so is there anything you would tell someone who is studying anthropology out there, young girls that might want to be an anthropologist? What advice would you give?
Take every opportunity that you're presented with, even if you don't think that you've got a chance, because you never ever know. Honestly, like, you would be a fool to pass up any possible opportunity that you're afforded.
Oh, I love it. And it really worked out well for you.
It really did. That's the thing that's been really driven home with me, is that if I hadn't taken this chance on the, completely, I was so skeptical when I submitted my resume. I was so skeptical that I would ever even get a look in. And, 2 years later, I've helped describe this material.
Yeah. I mean, you've made history, and not just in like a small sense, but in a very, very big sense. And so it's such an honor to talk to you. So thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to do that.
Thank you.
After speaking to Ellen, who was lovely and wonderful, as you can see, I had the opportunity to speak to Becca Pisciotto, who was fantastic. And she tells us about the integral role multiple women on the dig had on this find. And it's a fascinating story.
Hi, my name is Becca Pisciotto. I'm a PhD student at American University in Washington, D.C., and I'm an archaeologist, and I was one of the primary excavators on the Rising Star expedition.
So this is fantastic. We've talked in depth about this dig on the podcast, but I really want to know a lot about you first. So what got you interested in this field of study?
One of the things that got me interested in archaeology is how multidisciplinary it is. I'm really excited about history. It's been something I've been interested in for a long time. In history, I enjoy science. I enjoy being outdoors. And I enjoy learning about people and doing anthropological kinds of study. And in archaeology, that's an opportunity to do all of those things together. And to answer some important questions about people for whom we don't know that much about.
So you've had an interest in this for a long time. Is there anything that inspired you to become an archaeologist?
I hadn't really considered archaeology as a career until I came back to graduate school for the second time several years ago. I had been working for a long time doing outdoor and experiential education, leading wilderness expeditions, working with youth, working with veterans, in an outdoor setting, rock climbing, backpacking, all that kind of stuff. It was really when I came back to graduate school that it occurred to me that I could combine all of these interests I had into one field that I could be excited about, and that would be archaeology.
So you already had a background in caving. Do you think that was that played into your opportunity to be on this dig?
Absolutely. In fact, when I first saw the ad looking for archaeologists that had climbing and caving experience, that was something that jumped out at me, a real chance to put all of those skills that I had together into one exciting and interesting research project. And I think my background doing those kinds of activities for work and for myself, for personal trips, I think that really played a big role in me being interested in the project and also in me ultimately being selected for it.
Tell us about your first experience when you go to South Africa, what that was like for you.
There were a lot of unknowns, even getting on the plane. It was such a quick turnaround, and we didn't really know that much from the time of the interview to getting our plane tickets, or for me at least, to getting my plane tickets and then getting on the plane. So going to South Africa, there were a lot of unknowns. Here I was going to meet Professor Lee Berger, who is a renowned paleoanthropologist, and I was going to meet five other people about whom I knew next to nothing. We'd emailed just a little bit between each other about what kinds of clothes we should pack for this thing. So there were a lot of unknowns going into it, and that was exciting and maybe a little bit intimidating to start with, but, of course, we got there, and we're all there for the same reason and have diverse backgrounds, but similar interests, and quickly got the hang of working together and hanging out together and all of that. You know, everyone else that I've talked to, it sounds like Lee was an amazing team leader, and he was really inspiring. Do you want to talk about your experience with him and just kind of how you viewed the overall, I guess, dynamics of the team you were working with?
Sure. Lee is an inspiring person to work for. His enthusiasm is catching. And that's really, really terrific to see in someone in his position, that he's so enthusiastic and he's so excited about sharing paleoanthropology and to opening up the field, and giving early career scientists opportunities that they might not ordinarily have. And that, that made me feel comfortable going into the project, as, you know, in the first several days. And it's an enthusiasm that just keeps you going, even when it's been several long days in a row of excavating in the cave, that there's someone when you come out of the cave that's so excited to see everything you're doing. And that's terrific. And of course, it wasn't just Lee. There were Professor John Hawks and Peter Schmidt and Scott Williams and all of these other really fantastic scientists and amazing researchers that occupy positions in which they could say, oh, you're just a young anthropologist, you're just a young archaeologist, what do you know? But they were excellent mentors to us, and it felt like we were working collaboratively and working as part of a team, and that also is energizing.
So this podcast is called The Story of Woman, and we try to focus on, you know, the history, if you will. I know that's a complicated term, especially for anthropologists and archaeologists, but mm-hmm. the history of women and the women doing this work. So do you want to talk about the women on the project and maybe what it was like to be a woman on the project and working with other women?
So there were the six of us women who were the primary excavators on the project. And we came from, you know, we were all in graduate school. Well, I was in between applying for my PhD program. We all had advanced degrees in archaeology or anthropology. We all had lots of experience excavating and doing various kinds of analyses. And we also had experience working in similar environments, not necessarily a cave. And I think people want to hear that it was, that there was competition amongst the six of us. I get asked that question a lot. What was it like to work with six women down in a cave? And I think people want to hear that there was competition, but really it was very collaborative all the time. We supported each other, and we had a good time in the cave, and we relaxed when we weren't in the cave, and we drew upon each other's skill sets and knowledge bases to learn from each other and to do the best science that we could in the conditions we were working in.
I noticed that it seems like there is this, I hate to use the word sisterhood, there seems to be this feeling of camaraderie amongst all of you, and I think that's what makes it so exciting to me as well.
Yeah, there is a feeling of camaraderie, certainly amongst the six of us, but with us and the support cavers. You know, there's women that were involved in this project that we're not seeing a lot of in the media, and we don't see a lot of on the video. There were women in the local caving society that were providing support for us in the cave and helping to string the cables for the lights and the cameras and running fossils in and out and providing safety support, that are just, you know, fun people to hang out with and really amazing women in the caving society really is dominated by men, but there they are doing this kind of caving. And then in the science tent and the command tent on the surface, there were lots of other women who are paleoanthropologists who were playing other kinds of roles in the project, from helping to analyze and catalog fossils to just doing the keeping everybody in order, really running the logistics of the show, making sure that the technology was working correctly, and all of these other things that we don't see a lot of. It's not front and center in the project, but women were really integral throughout the whole project, and were integrated into the whole project in all the aspects.
Oh, I really appreciate you bringing that up. I think that's so critical. And
And it's inspiring because, you know, since our first interview with Hannah, I've had a lot of messages of people saying, I listened to this interview with my daughter, and it's inspired my daughter to, you know, grow up and say she wants to be a scientist. And I think that's exactly what I think you all have done. And so to hear that there are multiple ways to sort of do this work, whether it's, you know, going down in the cave, doing the dig, or doing all of these other sort of support positions, I think it's fantastic. What advice would you give to those, maybe, you know, maybe it's a stay-at-home mom that has always had an interest in, you know, archaeology, but never really had the courage to go back and get her degree, or maybe, you know, a girl that is deciding what she wants to be when she grows up, or maybe it's a professional in the field already. What advice would you give them?
I live in Maryland, and in the state of Maryland, there's a group called the Archaeology Society of Maryland. It's the Avocational Archaeology Group, and there are professional archaeologists and people who do archaeology as a hobby or as a passion or as an interest. Some of them are retired, some of them are working in other jobs or have children and those kinds of, you know, that come from all different aspects of life. And I think if someone were interested in archaeology and wanted to learn more about it, that finding their local archaeology society would be a really great place to start, to meet people in the community of archaeology, and you know, you're not committing yourself to a PhD in the field or anything. You can learn about it and be exposed to it and contribute to finding out the history of the area you're living in. I think that's one really, really great thing. For young people who are thinking that they might be interested in science, you know, with social media and with the internet, there's so many ways to reach out to other women who do science in all kinds of fields. And I would, you know, if you're looking for somebody that does a particular kind of science, I would say look on something like Trailblazers or just search for the kind of science you're interested in and find a woman who has a position in a research organization or at a university and send them an email or send them a tweet or find them on Facebook. It seems to me that right now that women who are doing science are, many of them are very motivated and excited to talk to other young women who are interested in science and to provide mentorship or offer advice or suggestions or share information with them. So I would say to reach out if that's something you're interested in.
And that's why I appreciate you being, that's why I appreciate you being willing to talk to us, because I think that's exactly what you're doing. And, you know, I know you guys are so busy and things are so crazy and you took the time to do this, which is fantastic. So I really appreciate that. Do you have any projects that you're working on now that you want to tell us about?
I work on a project. My dissertation research is in the Great Dismal Swamp, which is on the border of Virginia and North Carolina. I work with a professor called Dan Sayers at American University, and it's another one of those big team projects. There are many of us that work on this project from different angles. We have historians and sociologists and social geographers and a bunch of archaeologists and geophysicists, all kinds of people work on this project, both men and women, and we all work together very effectively. And one of the things that I really, really am excited about the Great Dismal Swamp is our purpose is to uncover the history of marginalized people, people whose stories were really not told very well in their own time. So we're particularly interested in Maroons, or what people might commonly call runaway slaves, although as anthropologists, we don't like to talk about them in that way. But we particularly look at Maroons and how they came into this environment that was really inhospitable and made lives for themselves, sort of against what would be possible outside of the swamp. And it's exciting to me to find out about this group of people and all of the things they had to overcome and how they created lives for themselves.
This is so great. And so when we, you know, the series is going to sort of work up in chronological order, which is, you know, difficult to do. But as we get closer to that period of time, maybe we could reach out to you again and people in your, is it a department?
It's a department, yeah.
Yeah, and find more about it because, you know, amplifying the voices of the unheard and the marginalized is something that I'm really passionate about. And, you know, as a white, middle-class woman, American woman, I find that challenging sometimes. I just really appreciate anyone who's doing the work to amplify those voices. So that's really exciting.
It's been really fun to talk to you. Thank you. I appreciate the questions you've asked. They're really, really interesting questions and fun to answer.
The last interview that I got to do was with Marina Elliott. And she, as you'll hear, she's incredibly articulate and incredibly smart. And she speaks a lot on being a woman involved in the sciences and the incredible gravity of the find and being part of this dig. I just am so inspired. So hopefully you'll enjoy this interview as well.
My name is Marina Elliott. I'm currently a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of the Witwatersrand in South Africa. I'm originally from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. But for the last 15 years until I moved to South Africa, I'd been living in Vancouver, Canada.
Awesome. Okay. So how did you get involved in the Naledi dig?
I got involved actually with the dig. Lee Berger put out a Facebook ad looking for excavators with a particular skill set. And my supervisor at the time at Simon Fraser University sent me an email and said, you know, this looks like an interesting opportunity. I don't suppose you have caving experience. And as it turned out, I had both caving and climbing experience and was just finishing a PhD in biological anthropology. So I really thought that the description suited me.
Let's talk about this a little bit. How did you even get interested in biological anthropology to begin with?
It was actually, I got interested in biological anthropology actually a little bit circuitously. I had done a bunch of traveling after high school and then actually did veterinary nursing or animal health technology for a number of years. So I'd always been interested in anatomy and physiology, but then I decided to have a career change, went back to university and got kind of sidetracked by anthropology. So it was just, I've always had an interest in science and evolution and human origins. So I don't know. It was just kind of a natural progression. I got into university and took a couple classes and thought, oh, this is something that interests me. And yeah, just kept going.
So the field of science is really exploding with women, you know, sort of claiming their power and fitting really nicely into all of these fields of study. So did you ever feel challenged or discouraged being a woman in this field?
You know what? I don't think I did. I have an extremely supportive family. My mother is a nurse. My father is an engineer. So education was always very important in our family, but also, I was always encouraged to do whatever I wanted to do. And that included, you know, very physical things like hiking and climbing and caving. So I was basically always told that if I wanted something, that if I was willing to work at it and put the effort in, that there weren't really barriers to what I wanted to do. So I'm very lucky that way. And I have been very fortunate both in my life and in my academic career.
Tell us about being on this project. You get there. What are your initial impressions of the project?
Yeah, that's a good one too. You know, Lee and I had 60 people apply. So he went through this selection process and we had talked on Skype at length actually about what was involved. And he was very careful to reinforce with us, I think, that this was in fact, you know, a full-on cave system and that this wasn't going to be easy, that there were, you know, physical challenges as well as, you know, excavation challenges and all the rest of it. So I was pretty clear on the idea that, you know, it would be an adventure. And I had seen some photographs of the material that we were going to be excavating, but just the odd ones that had been on the surface. Seeing the cave for the first time, you know, all of that, both the cave itself and then the resulting excavation work were both more amazing than I was led to believe at the beginning. But just generally very exciting.
So if you were to tell me your, I know this is going to be a hard question to answer, but your favorite memory on the dig, what would it be?
Gosh, yeah, there are a lot of favorite memories, actually. You know, one of my favorite memories, actually, is just, I don't know why, in particular, one afternoon, Becca Pasciotto and Hannah Morris and I were working underground. And, you know, I think we'd been down 2 or 3 hours. And we were all excavating quite quietly, you know, concentrating on what we were doing. And so it was very cool and quiet and quite lovely in the cave. And we were all just sort of working on our own little areas. And I just remember kind of looking up and thinking, wow, I mean, think about this as kind of a job. How crazy is this? But just being really struck by how wonderful it was to be able to work. I mean, the whole team was fantastic, but how wonderful it was to be able to work with such an exceptional group of people on such an exceptional project.
Did you have any real paradigm shifts while you were engaging in this work?
Oh, paradigm shifts. I think, well, probably not a paradigm shift, but certainly lots of sort of epiphany moments. You know, one of the things that was very interesting about the project and very difficult for all of us to get our heads around initially, was the fact that, you know, the more we excavated, the more material we got out and the more individuals we were, you know, were represented. And yet we were still not finding any other animals in the chamber. And so that took a lot of thinking about and, you know, coming to, as you probably know, the hypothesis that the team has come to about this being a deliberate disposal area, you know, really took a lot of thinking through. And I mean, that was, I wouldn't say a paradigm shift, but it was something that, you know, was really fascinating to kind of turn over in our minds, especially once we realized that we were definitely not dealing with a human individual, you know, human group. It was a something other, and to try and think about how another species might have had sufficient intelligence or consciousness to actually perform this act was pretty exciting and interesting.
Yeah, and I think it's something everyone's going to be talking about for a long, long time.
Absolutely, yeah.
Tell us what is the most, I guess maybe you answered that, but what would you want people to know about the Naledi? If there's one thing that you could say about them, especially as, you know, this podcast focuses on the stories of women in relation to women, is there anything unique or special about the female species of, the female of the Naledi?
The Naledi species. You know, I think at this point, that's a question that we don't have a lot of answers to. And as I said, we do have 15 individuals represented and in all age groups from very young infants to, you know, very old adults of both sexes. And so, you know, I find it fascinating to think about a species, not just as an individual, as is so often the case in paleoanthropology. You just get, you know, part of one individual, and that's what you have to work with. And so for me to think about this species, Homo naledi, as more holistically as a population and as, you know, family units and as integrated groups, I think is very interesting. And in terms of, you know, women specifically, you know, I think it's certainly interesting to think about how family units might have worked and who was doing the caregiving and all of that kind of thing. Those are questions we may or may not ever be able to answer, but it's certainly fascinating to think about.
Yeah. And I think that that's what's so exciting about the work that you're doing and that others are doing is it's one piece in a really big, exciting puzzle. And it's really fun from my perspective just to sort of sit back and let you guys do all the hard work, but really enjoy the fruits of your efforts.
Yeah.
So tell us about what you're up to now.
Yeah, since the original excavation, which was in November of 2013, two of us, Becca Pasciotto and I, also went back in March of 2014 for another round of excavation. And then I was fortunate enough to be part of the analysis and description of the material that happened as a workshop in May of 2014. Then I was able to finish my PhD and I accepted a postdoctoral research position at VITS last October. So I've been here almost a year now. So I'm continuing to do research on the Naledi material and also continue with excavations and explorations around the cradle of humankind. So that that part is really wonderful for me. I've always enjoyed field work. And so it's really nice to be able to do both and continue to research.
Fantastic. Well, we just really appreciate you coming on. Is there any advice you would give? I've asked your colleagues this, but any advice you would give to maybe young girls listening to this that might be interested in becoming an anthropologist or an archaeologist or a scientist, or maybe women out there that are studying in the field right now?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of things I would say, but probably most importantly is, you know, just get out there and do it. Don't let anybody tell you you can't. If you are, you know, are serious and passionate about something and you love what you do, go for it. You know, there's obviously any profession, and this goes for paleoanthropology as well, requires lots of hard work and a certain skill set, but there's no reason that, you know, anyone can't just say, you know, yeah, that's what I want to do and make it happen. And I think in terms of the exploration work, again, you know, there's no reason that women shouldn't be out there doing, you know, doing the hard work, doing the adventurous stuff, the dangerous stuff, with the right skills and the right education. You know, there's no barrier to what you can accomplish if you're committed to it. So yeah, just really get out there and do it. Don't be scared.
Well, thank you so much. You guys are such an inspiration. The work that you're doing is so important. And I just want to give a big collective thank you from everybody that's benefiting from your hard work. So thank you again.
Well, thank you very much. It's, you know, I think for all of us, there's a whole host of women mentors and inspirational, you know, people, both famous and not, along the way in our lives that have really inspired us. And so, you know, that's really important. This takes a village to raise a child. And, I think all of us really appreciate that we're part of something larger. And then even with the expedition, you know, a lot of focus has been on the six of us, but there was a whole team of incredible people, both men and women, who were there and supported us and were really integral to making our work successful. So I think that's something that I really like to reinforce as well.
Talking to these women, not only do I get a sense of overwhelming humility and just a down-to-earthness of each of them for taking the time out of their busy schedules to come and talk on this podcast. They were so fun and great to talk to and just really connected with me on many levels. I don't know about you, but I was really, really inspired to listen to them. Bordering on envy. Their stories are fantastic and they are fantastic and they're just an inspiration for us all. And I really hope that this is an interview you can listen to with your daughters and those who maybe are interested in the sciences and want to do something about it. These women are inspiration and they're showing us how. Thanks for listening to another episode of Story of Woman Podcast. The Story of Woman Podcast is produced by Lindsay Hanson Park. We are generously sponsored by Bluehost and Bluehost.com. Bluehost is one of the largest and most trusted web hosting services powering millions of websites. If you go and get on Bluehost right now, you can get a free domain name. The web art is designed by Geraldine Hassel-Poole, with the music provided generously by Lady Murasaki. Check them out at ladymurasaki.bandcamp.com. If you like what you heard today, consider a donation at storywoman.org.